This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're broadcasting today from San Antonio, Texas, where, of course, the main attraction is the Alamo, which has been extensively studied by archaeologists. And, you know, when you talk about the Lone Star State, you don't normally associate it, I think most people don't, with archaeology. But by some estimates, there are as many as a million archaeological sites in Texas spanning over 13,000 years of history. Every object that is found, be it an arrow point or the stones of a campfire, well, they all help archaeologists form a picture of what life was like for people in Texas 200, 2,000, 12,000 years ago, how people got their food, what they ate, what their social groups were like, how they spent their leisure time, if they had any, and just some of the questions that archaeologists are trying to answer. And believe it or not, too, today is the first day of Texas Archaeology Awareness Month. Did you know that? Yeah, it is. We've gathered the top archaeologists in the area to talk about some of the archaeological sites in the state, so you don't even have to get your hands dirty. We'll do that for you right up here at our table. And if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're in the audience here today at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, please, you're invited to step up to the microphones on both sides of the room, and we'd love to hear your questions. Let me get to my guests. James E. Brousseff is the director of the Archaeology Division at the Texas Historical Commission in Austin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Michael Collins is research associate at the Texas Archaeological Research Laboratory. That's part of the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Steve A. Tomka is the director of the Center for Archaeological Research, also at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.
It's actually here in San Antonio.
In San Antonio.
I should
read what it says on the paper. I get it right. thank you for being with us today. And Britt Bausman is the director of the Center for Archaeological Studies at Texas State University. That's in San Marcos.
That right? is in
I
San Marcos.
I got that one right. Thank you there for being with us today. Let me talk with you first, Dr. Brousseff, about this famous ship, the Belle. Before we get into excavation, tell us about this little ship that's so interesting, and give us a little bit of the history and what happened to it.
Well, my agency, the Texas Historical Commission, we've been looking for that ship, had been looking for that ship for a number of years, and we've had a lot of fun with it. It is a ship, one of four, that the famous French explorer La Salle brought with him to the New World to establish a colony at the mouth of the Mississippi River. He missed the Mississippi River and ended up on the Texas coast, and in the process lost all of his ships but La Belle. And then after a period of several months, he lost that ship as well, with a lot of the cargo he had left for his colony on that ship. And so my agency has been looking for that, realizing that that would be a major shipwreck discovery if we could find that. And off and on since 1978, we started the search off and on, looking for it. And in 1995, actually, luck was with us, and we found that ship in Matagorda Bay in about 12 feet of water, not very deep water, but the problem was it was zero visibility and therefore difficult to really do much diving and recovery of artifacts.
But you built something unique around the ship. You built a dam, a cofferdam, and pumped the water out? And you lived in that little spot for a while?
That's exactly right. We realized we had one of the most important shipwreck discoveries in North America. From the historical records, we knew that it could have a lot of cargo still there. So we felt like we needed to preserve and excavate and preserve it in the best possible manner. And to do that, a traditional underwater diving excavation would be difficult in zero visibility. You can do that, but you can't really see things. And in that part of Matagorda Bay, we have a high profusion of jellyfish who like to sting you on the skin as you're diving down.
I hate it when that happens.
Yes, very, very bad. Yeah. So we decided we would try something that had never been done before in North America and build this giant steel drum, what's called a cofferdam, around it, and that would allow us to pump the water out and excavate it, much like a land archaeological site.
And so you did that and brought up artifacts from the ship?
We started that in 1996. We built the cofferdam during the summer of 1996. In the fall, we started the excavations, working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and over a period of about 7 months, we brought up over a million artifacts that basically represent a kit for building a colony in the 17th century New World. The only place in the world we know of those artifacts having been found together. And then we brought up the ship itself.
All right, we'll talk about more of that later as we get into the conversation. I want to bring each one of you in and we can talk a little bit about what you all do. Now, Michael Collins, you're at the other end of the spectrum in terms of time, right? You look at sites that were occupied 12,000 years ago.
You know, the sites I work with are, I'm not. Jim and I are about the same age. Yes, I'm interested in the earliest cultures in the Americas era, and that's been a contentious notion from the beginning. Archaeologists have honed a theory since 1932, 72 years now, that the first peoples in the Americas were what we call the Clovis culture,
right,
of around 12,000 years ago, and that these were people that walked out of Asia on a land bridge during lowered sea levels during the Ice Ages.
Over the Bering Straits.
The Bering Straits, yeah. Exactly. Down an ice-free corridor between the two great ice sheets of Canada, spread out into North America, where there was this just a Serengeti of large game, that they hunted that game. Large animals, they were presumably hunted to extinction. And that was supposedly the story of the founding of the population of the Native Americans. Over the last 30 years, I have been working on archaeological sites that suggest that's not true, sites that date before Clovis. And I can assure you that to stand up among my colleagues and say I have evidence of people in the Americas before Clovis is guaranteed to bring the wrath of the profession down upon you.
I can see the marks from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune on you.
Exactly. The small number of us that have been in that position for a long time refer to the establishment archaeologist as the Clovis police. And we have felt their nightsticks and their handcuffs for a long time. But the tide is turning. We now have sites that are being widely accepted that date before Clovis. Having worked on the most prominent of those, Monte Verde in southern Chile, with a 12,500 radiocarbon age, I had gotten tired of being maligned for reporting the evidence that I saw. And I decided in the early 1990s that I would like to find some Clovis sites that supported my notion that Clovis does not match the theoretical proposition that it was the first culture in the Americas. Just about the time I made that decision, my phone rang. It was some landowners telling us of their site on their land, which turned out to be the largest, most complex Clovis archaeological site known in North America. And it contains abundant evidence that Clovis is too complex, too articulated with its local environment to be a founding, that leavings of a founding population.
And so we'll get more into that because this is all fascinating. I want to just, as I say, bring you all in to the discussion. Now, Dr. Tomke, you have done work on missions in the San Antonio era. Tell us a little about the history of the missions and the items that you find there.
Sure. We have done at the center work on the mission since pretty much the mid-70s, and over the 35, 40 years accumulated an amazing amount of knowledge on the four or five missions in the San Antonio area and in Texas throughout the state. One of the things that's really interesting about it is that we have quite a bit of public input into it and quite a bit of public interest because many of the settlers into San Antonio really had come about and lived and worked and played among the ruins over the last 200-300 years. And so there's such a public familiarity and public interest in this type of archaeology that we want to, through the center, we want to sort of build on that and try to bring in the population at large to learn about their own history in some ways, because it's part of what they grew up with, part of what their grandparents have talked about, and we want to, in some ways, re-educate the public and the children of the grandparents who worked and lived and played in San Antonio. So it's a very wonderful environment for us to be working in.
Interesting. Dr. Bousman, tell us a little bit about your specialty. You look at the transitional period between the Paleo-Indians to the Archaic. Can you tell us in English what that means to all of us?
Dr. Collins indicated, the earliest period in North American prehistory is known as the Paleo-Indian period. It's the period when it's characterized often that these were big game hunters and they lived in small groups and they were the initial groups that populated the country. At the end of the Ice Ages, which occurred about 10,000 years ago, the environment changed dramatically. There were over 33 different genuses of animals that went extinct. And what we're looking at is how the peoples that lived in these areas adapted to that change. When they came out of, there was a period of experimentation about 2,000, 2,500 years or so. And when they came out of that period of experimentation, they are what we characterize as archaic hunters and gatherers. These are modern hunters and gatherers that living during the modern Holocene period. But what we've been looking at is how this transformation occurred. And we had been thinking it was a fairly simple process, but based on a couple of sites, one of which Mike and Collins and I excavated, Wilson Leonard, it's actually more complex than that. It's a very sort of unpredictable record, and people are changing in different ways in different areas, and so we're looking at how that changed to what is, I think, agreeably the most dramatic environmental change that occurred in North America during the period that there were humans on this continent.
When you say environmental, you mean the climate?
Climatic, environmental.
Was there something that actually...
The climate...
A delineation that you can see that changed dramatically?
Yes.
When was that?
But the boundary is usually accepted at 10,000 years ago, radiocarbon years.
Is that the Ice Age?
It's the end of the Ice Age. It's when all the Pleistocene animals, and we're talking about mammoths, mastodons, saber-toothed cats, dire wolves, all of these, and a lot of other species as well, all these species went extinct. But we can also, by looking at fossil pollens, we can show that the plant communities were dramatically different in the Pleistocene than they are now. And a lot of what we do is look at how the environment's changed and how the people adapted to these changes. And you're seeing some very sophisticated changes at a very early stage here in Texas. And we're just now starting to map this out. I'll put a plug in this. We're doing a symposium at the Society for American Archaeology where we're taking a group of scientists, archaeologists throughout North America, and they're all addressing this problem from California to Florida.
So. Is it just because I said at the beginning you don't think of Texas as being an archaeological treasure trove, but from listening to all you're saying, there's a lot here going on. You don't hear much about it. You know?
Absolutely.
You need better...
We need to have more PR.
Better press.
More NPR.
Ooh, let me write that down. Speaking of which, we're going to have to take a short break, and we're going to come back, and then we'll get into each one of your topics because it's quite very interesting stuff that you're working on. I'm particularly interested in the history of the area. And I know Dr. Brusethi, you've got a lot of stuff about the ship you want to talk about. There are a lot of artifacts, including some coins. I know there was there even a skull that was, right? It was a skull brought up?
We found a complete skeleton on our ship, yes.
And did you ever identify who it was?
We tried to, and we thought through DNA analysis we might be able to do that. And we did find a lot of DNA, but unfortunately none of it was his DNA. It was from critters that were living in and around his skeletal remains.
Wow. Who needs CSI, right? All right, we're gonna fact is stranger than fiction. We're gonna come back and talk more with James Rousseff, Michael Collins, Steve Tomka, and Britt Bousman, and take your questions. Our number 1-800-989-8255 here in the auditorium. Don't be afraid to step up to the mics. We'll be right back after the short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato, and we're talking this hour about archaeology, focusing in on Texas archaeology. We're here at in San Antonio and talking with James Brusseth, Director of the Archaeology Division at the Texas Historical Commission in Austin, Michael Collins, Research Associate at the Texas Archaeological Research Laboratory and also at the University of Texas at Austin. Steve A. Tomka is Director of the Center for Archaeological Research at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And Britt Bousman is the Director of the Center for Archaeological Studies at Texas State University in San Marcos. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We left for the break. I was talking with James Brusseth about La Belle, the ship. What was the most exciting thing that you brought up from this ship?
I think the most exciting thing I brought up was a silver coin that we found. I should add that we brought up lots of terribly interesting things, but the silver coin was curious. When I first brought it up in 1996 in the fall, we couldn't tell what it was. It was too badly corroded, and so we sent it off to Texas A&M University, and the laboratory there is cleaning all of our artifacts and preserving them. And I'd say about a year later, they called me up and they said, well, we've cleaned up that coin, and you won't believe what it is. And I said, well, it's got to be a French Louis the 14th something or other. And they said, no, it's a Roman coin, and it dates to the year AD 69, and it has the image of the Emperor Otho Caesar on it.
Wow.
And I about fell over when they told me that, and I was thinking, how in the world did a Roman coin get on a shipwreck in the bed of Matagorda Bay in Texas? And the only thing I can come up with is that must have been a good luck charm that one of the sailors picked up at a Roman ruin in France and brought with him to the New World.
What a story. And you eventually raised the whole ship? Is it sitting in a museum someplace?
Well, we raised the whole ship. We first excavated the cargo, and the cargo was mostly in barrels and boxes, exactly as LaSalle had put it into the ship over 300 years ago. And it was amazing. My office place during the excavation of the ship was inside this cofferdam where we had part of the waters of Matagorda Bay, and we were excavating into the bed of Matagorda Bay. And each day I'd get to open up a new box or barrel of objects that LaSalle had brought with him to the New World. And it was just incredible to see those kinds of things. But we excavated all the cargo, and when we finished with that, we dismantled the ship timber by timber and hauled everything up to Texas A&M University, where they're doing the treatment and the conservation of those artifacts. One of the things on marine archaeology, when you bring up artifacts, they can't dry out until they're preserved, and it takes techniques and certain kinds of chemicals to do that, and many of those artifacts now have been preserved and are in museums around Texas.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to a question from the audience here on the right. Yes, sir.
So I actually have two questions, one for Dr. Collins, one for Dr. Bousman. Dr. Collins, are there plans right now to re-excavate any Clovis sites in or around Texas under the pre-Clovis paradigm to see if they yield older results?
Yes, there are. That's a good question. Most immediate is we hope to return to the Galt site, which is this spectacular Clovis site. The last few days that we were excavating there 2.5 years ago, we dug down below the Clovis levels, and we were continuing to find artifacts, and we obtained OSL, optically stimulated luminescent dates on the sediments at ages about 500 years older than Clovis. So we're very anxious when the time is right to return and investigate that more fully.
Let me just follow up on this. If you don't think that the route was taken over the Bering Strait and down those ice that you described earlier, where did the people come from?
Well, I guess what we've done is we've sort of scrapped our old theory, and the agenda's open. We've got lots of competing alternative theories. One of them is that people may have come around the North Pacific and down the west coast of North America by boat. One is they may have come across the North Atlantic by boat to the eastern seaboard. They may have worked their way along the coastlines of Western North America. My view is not necessarily one answer to that. People may have come from the east and from the west. It'll be a long time before we have a replacement theory to the longstanding Clovis theory. My hope is that whatever the new replacement theory is, we have a lot of confidence in it, that we've done our work correctly and can say that we've satisfied all of the sciences that need to be satisfied, that we have the right answer.
One would suspect that then there should be other sites along that period of where they traveled, right, that should yield the same kind of fossilized or same kind of archaeological finds that you find?
Absolutely.
And are people looking for them also?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are quite a few sites now with evidence of pre-Clovis human presence. Some of these, I just learned of one yesterday in Nevada that's very exciting. So these sites are turning up quite frequently that now that people are taking the time to look carefully.
You had a question for
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Bousman?
Dr. Bousman, you said a few minutes ago we need more PR. Do you think that popular fiction with stories set during periods of prehistory assists the scientific community by generating public interest or hampers it by spreading misinformation about the periods?
Do you have anything in particular in mind? Popular? Do you have any popular...
In particular, the area of children's literature.
Uh-huh. I think popular fiction can have a big impact and a positive impact. It needs to be done, you know, correctly. I think the Indiana Jones model of archaeology is not a very useful model that we work under, at least.
oh no!
Sorry, I hate to
you
say.
You know, they don't have that big ball rolling after you and grab the thing out of.
Yeah, you'd ask my wife. I never pack my gun when I leave.
But if you did, you'd get more publicity doing that.
Or arrested, I'm not sure.
That's publicity.
Yeah, well, trying to be positive.
So that's not really how you work. What is the life of an archaeologist like then? Pretty boring?
There's a lot of tedium. When you pull a million artifacts out of the ground, you have to look at every one. It's 11 or 12:30 at night, and you're pretty much cross-eyed at that stage of the game. There's a lot of tedium involved. Everyone thinks it's the Indiana Jones stuff, but it's sitting at a table, looking at thousands and thousands of artifacts for months at a time.
And even before you pull anything out of the ground, you have to document exactly where it is.
Everything. Right? Everything really has to be mapped. You know. Everything.
And isn't that a big difference than when it was 100 years ago, when people just looting places and taking stuff home with them and. They really had no scientific value because they were not placed.
Right. There were people, 100 years ago that were doing, at least for the time, fairly careful work, and we were able to use that information. I was thinking of this on the drive up. There was a collector in South Texas by the name of A.E. Anderson who collected and recorded sites. He was, does anybody know what his profession was? Was he a dentist? I think he was a dentist, but I may be wrong. Anyway, I may be thinking of Ray. But he collected and recorded what he collected. And that database that he amassed, which is now at the University of Texas, is still a very, very valuable research record that we use. So it can be done, but it is tedious. And so to get back to the gentleman's question, I think there is a positive role that can be played, but we have to get away from the idea that archaeology is nothing more than going out and grabbing things and taking them home in your pocket. It is a science. It's a very rigorous science that requires a lot of attention. That has a short attention span with kids, I'm afraid, but it still can be done. If you look at the series, was it the Magic School Bus?
Right.
They have tried to approach this certainly with paleontology and I think with archaeology.
Well, I mean, I almost say this almost half jokingly, but if you can have a show like CSI where you're in a crime scene investigation, you could have an archaeology site and some other kind if you're creative enough, right?
Sure, absolutely.
You're doing some of the same kinds of forensic.
Yeah, items. I mean, when they're sort of dead bodies lying around, there's more interest, I think.
It's like they call it the high concept in Hollywood. Well,
much of archaeology is really akin to forensic science. Mm-hmm. It's forensic science. We're investigating scenes, not necessarily crime scenes,
right,
from hundreds or thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm.
Now, Steve Tomka, you have somewhat of an advantage over these other archaeologists in that you work in other time periods, right, where there are records.
Right. That's one of the beauties of our section of the field, at least dealing with the mission archaeology or colonial period archaeology, is that we do have the records that the Spanish left for us. They were amazingly good record keepers, and ever since the late 1600s, when they first came into the state, they documented where they put their missions, the sizes of the missions, the buildings that were there, the population that lived there, the comings and goings of the Indian groups that were coming in. So that does offer a bit of information that is not available for prehistoric archaeologists, though you have to take some of that with a grain of salt as well. As always, any written record has a certain axe to grind, a certain position to take, a certain position to make. And so in some ways, as Mike and Britt have mentioned, in doing the archaeology, we're doing sort of a ground truthing of exactly what the record says versus what the record indicates in the ground. And we have, you know, the missions that we have really run from the late 1600s in East Texas all the way to the early 1800s when they finally become fully secularized. So we do have about a 300-year period of trying to ground through the history of the Spanish Empire, really, which is in some ways geopolitics played out in the New World, fight between the Spanish and the French interests in the New World.
I asked Dr. Brousseff what his most interesting object from the Labell was. He said it was a gold coin. Did you have something that you would classify as your most interesting find at a mission?
I've thought about that for a long time, and it's really not, for me, it's really not so much a one particular find, but when you look at years and years worth of research and you start putting the patterns together of exactly, you know, how the native culture changed, for instance, as a result of missionization, as a result of being brought into a totally foreign culture, trying to be made in the image of what the Spanish thought the Native Americans should look like, seeing the changes in the technology that the natives came in with and how that technology changed over time, over the 200 years that the natives were impacted by the Spanish. Those kinds of patterns, to me, are really the fascinating ones, because that's really telling us about culture change. That's telling us how people change. And in some ways, it offers parallels to how the current world works today.
I understand you found a piece of China down there?
Right. We find several pieces of China, as a matter of fact, Chinese porcelain from China. And to me, that's, again, a very interesting and good example of geopolitics being played out in the 1600s, 1700s. By that point, Seville and Spain was really importing in communication with China. So they were really importing to Spain ceramics, porcelain, and from there it was being loaded onto ships in Seville, brought out to Acapulco, offloaded there, sent overland to Mexico City, and then all those influential Franciscan fathers who had missions in New Texas, basically, were able then to convince the people to, let's have a piece here and there. And so eventually, as early as the early 1700s, porcelain from China shows up in the New World and Texas missions.
Are you ever able to get under the mission itself to see if it's built on another mission or some rubble beneath it? The Alamo here, do we know everything there is? What's underneath
the
Alamo?
That's a very good question, and it's amazing how often missions are moved and missions are built on the locations of pre-existing missions. And then it's even to take it one step further, it's amazing how often those missions themselves are built on prehistoric villages themselves. For instance, at the Alamo is a very good example. We have an archaeological site, a prehistoric archaeological site right under there that is as rich as anything that you find later in time. So, and that, I think part of that is really due to the fact that when you find a good spot on the land, when it's close to a river, where it's productive land for whatever resource, then people will continue reoccupying it. And you see that from the prehistoric time continuing on to the historic period.
We're talking about archaeology this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News and archaeology in Texas. Our number 1-800-989-8255, please, here in the audience, if you want to know. This is your chance to ask about the archaeology of your state. And you may not get this shot at these scientists again. You throw out that little nugget about the Alamo. I can't pass it up. My journalistic juices are running here. What is under the Alamo? What have you said? There's a rich treasure trove of things. What's under there?
Late prehistoric and archaic archaeological site that dates back to probably about 1,500 years ago, as far as we know.
Oh, really?
The unfortunate thing is that that part of it is often not explored and excavated, because everybody really focuses on what's, you know, the more interesting, sort of more viable, more publicity-bringing, perhaps, portion of
the archaeological record. But you'd love to get under there, right?
You bet. Yeah, you bet.
Maybe we can push it a little. Couldn't they just give you a little piece of the site?
The way archaeology works is we've been doing archaeology there, and various folks really have been doing archaeology there for 20, 30 years. And little at a time, you end up excavating pits that go down that deep, and you do get that record. It's not as fully explored and not as well known as the post colonial mm-hmm. and colonial period, but such is life.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go to the phones, get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Ryan in New Orleans. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks. I want to thank you for the show. I always think your anthropology shows are the best of Science Friday.
Thank you.
I have a question for both of the guests that deal with both the Archaic and the pre-Clovis periods. I just wanted to know if they could explain the significance of skeletal studies to their studies. They've talked some about artifactual analysis and things like that, and how skeletal studies might contribute to a more comprehensive understanding of the pre-Clovis peopling of the Americas. And I guess to some extent I'm asking about, the importance of such finds, recent finds as like Kennoic Man or Buell and things like that. But just in general, how these things would relate to even, pre-Clovis in Texas.
All right. Michael Collins?
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
Great question. A substantial part of the answer to the question of where did the first Americans come from resides in the human skeletal evidence. And we don't have very much skeletal material dating older than 10,000 years ago, just a handful of such skeletons. What's interesting is they don't strongly resemble the skeletal remains of the typical American Indian, the Native Americans that we're so familiar with. This immediately raises the question, why are their physical types different? A quick way to investigate the answer to that is, what about the DNA? And here, too, the DNA of the earliest skeletal remains that we have in North and South America is somewhat different than that of the Native Americans of today. The problem is we're dealing with such tiny samples numerically, and we're sometimes dealing with DNA that has degraded somewhat chemically, so we don't get full pictures. But we are intensively studying the physical anthropology of the earliest skeletons as well as the DNA.
All right, we're going to take a break. Interesting stuff. Come back, take lots more of your questions. Don't go away. We'll talk more about archaeology, Texas archaeology, anything you'd like to talk about in that realm. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Texas archaeology, broadcasting from San Antonio, Texas, or San Antone, as they like to say, down here in the Lone Star State, with my guests James E. Brusseff, Michael Collins, Stephen A. Tomka, and Britt Bousman. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience for a question over here. Sir.
Yes, my question is for all the panelists and as to whether or not you ever recruit volunteers, novice volunteers, or free labor for your projects
yes.
in Texas.
Definitely.
You can't wait,
One thing, let me say that Texas has, I think, a unique record in the formation and the existence of what's known as the Texas Archaeological Society. There are a lot of other societies as well. But this is a society composed of avocational archaeologists and professionals. They've been active since 1929, and for probably the last 40 years or so, they've had a field school every summer. And their offices are housed where Dr. Tomka works at the Center for Archaeological Studies, and I strongly urge you to give them a call or look them up on the web.
There you go.
At the center as well, we offer a once-a-month dig at Mission Concepcion, one of the missions that was established in San Antonio in the 1730s. And you are welcome to come out. We take all ages, and you show up for a day. No prior training is necessary. We offer the training, and we welcome you out there to get dirty with us.
All right.
Another, if I can say one thing. Another organization here in San Antonio is the Rock Art Foundation. Their offices are not very far away, and they're also easily found on the web or the phone book.
Do you take summer interns for, like, kids in school, you know, over the summer?
I should also mention at the Texas Historical Commission, we actually have a group of volunteers that we've elevated to a higher status. They're called our archaeological stewards, and these are people that have certain levels of experience, although they are avocationals, and they're the eyes and ears for us out around the state to help identify what are issues out there that we at the staff level at the Historical Commission need to spend our time then to travel on out to investigate further.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Amanda in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Amanda.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question about what kind of conservation efforts are being done right now on the Bell.
We're going through very extensive conservation efforts on the artifacts we recovered at Texas A&M University. They have a world-class conservation laboratory there, and under contract with my agency, they're conserving literally everything. The wood is being treated with a chemical called polyethylene glycol, which up until a few years ago was an ingredient in Dr. Pepper, as well as several other chemicals, so that all those objects will be preserved and available for people to view for another 300 years and beyond.
Okay. You're eager to see it, I'll bet, right?
Pardon?
You're eager to come take a look at these artifacts.
Oh, I would love to.
So would we all. We need a little camera in there looking permanently on a website as you do. No. It's another idea I'll have to work on myself. Yes, sir, on the left here.
Oh, yes, my question is for Dr. Collins. Earlier you were talking about some of the like large animals that the natives would come into America that they would come to kill. I don't know if there's much much sites in Texas that reveal what kind of animals that they may have been hunting for game or what kind of large animals. And I've heard of a place in Glen Rose that has, I don't know if you've heard of this, has tracks of supposedly dinosaurs and man together. I don't know if you've investigated that or not. But just my basic question is just what kind of large animals do you think they'd be hunting?
We have direct evidence that they were hunting mammoths, horse, the large extinct form of bison. But the real story is that they were also living on small animals, frogs, turtles, squirrels, rabbits, animals of that sort. That was the daily diet for the earliest peoples that we know of in Texas. I suspect that these mammoth kills were the sort of event in a person's life that you experienced maybe once and then spent the rest of your life talking about it. it wasn't the mainstream life way of the earliest peoples.
What about this Flintstones concept that people were living at the same time as the dinosaurs? Okay, we hear this all the time, you know?
We do too. And it's simply not true. The dinosaur tracks that you're talking about at Glen Rose are 100 million years old. The oldest human evidence in Texas is around 14,000, perhaps, years ago. Huge time difference. There are beautiful dinosaur tracks in the Paluxy River, bedrock exposed in the bed of the Paluxy River. And there are some smaller tracks made by dinosaurs that resemble a human footprint, but they are not.
Mm-hmm. Considering that did you have the LaBelle wreck in shallow water there, would you not assume there are a lot of other wrecks out there that you've never found? I mean, like there are off the coast of Florida and Georgia, anywhere, you know, there's a large shoreline and you have hurricanes and wind that blow people onto the shore and stuff like that?
Texas has has hundreds of shipwrecks out there. And many of them are historic shipwrecks. Many of them we would like to find. The problem we have on Texas and the coastal areas throughout North America is that you have a lot of modern shipwrecks and then a lot of debris that was been put out in our waters. And so we typically use a magnetometer to find a shipwreck, which is like a super sensitive metal detector, but you seldom find the old shipwreck you're really looking for. And as a diver, one of the most, it can be a terrifying experience when you go on that first dive down to check out what's below the water, in the water, that your magnetometer has identified. You don't know if it's that old shipwreck you're looking for or maybe a shrimp boat that dates to 20, 30 years ago where the rigging is still, the netting is still out there. And when you go down in the Texas waters, it's zero visibility and you do everything by feel. So on that first dive, you always have your knife ready so that if you get tangled up, you can cut your way back out.
You need that side-looking radar and stuff, don't you? I mean, you need to get a little better equipment. Let's up this into the 21st century a little, you know. I'm a scuba diver. I'm not going down there with my knife, you know. I can understand why you're not doing it. You need some real equipment, you know.
We use radar from time to time, but it's expensive, and it's you know, divers are cheaper.
Enough said about the state of archaeology underwater in Texas. Sir, yes.
Hi, I had one question for Dr. Collins and one for Dr. Tomka. First of all, Dr. Collins, when you go to a site like the Galt site or Blackwater Draw, where you'd expect to find pre-Clovis material, and say, for example, Clovis stratum is immediately above bedrock, is that disheartening? And what kinds of evidence keeps you going when you know, the Clovis police try and come down on you with both feet?
Actually, you pointed out a very typical finding, and that is that oftentimes Clovis is in the earliest deposits at a particular site that are capable of holding human remains. What we do, we use geology to identify those places where older deposits exist, and we can then search those deposits. We date the deposits and then search the deposits of the right age for archaeological evidence. And that's beginning. That approach is relatively new, but it is beginning to pay off.
Thank you, Dr. Collins. Dr. Tomka, what kind of outreach programs are going on at UTSA over at Carr to get the community more involved? Sure.
As I indicated earlier, one of the things that we do want to do is to bring in a lot of the people that live in the city and a lot of the school kids, teachers. And so we do quite a bit of volunteering work. We have several volunteers, dozens of volunteers at the center working right now. We have internship programs. We have the public outreach excavations themselves that actually get people involved and exposed to touching artifacts that are 200-300 years old, seeing how things change, how cultures change at the missions. And so we're trying to bring home how interesting archaeology is on the one hand, and how easy it is to do it and get turned on as well and get that fire burning about the interest of archaeology.
Kids would seem natural to.
They are.
In the dirt, dig it up. You know?
Definitely, definitely. And we really have 16, 14, 15, 13-year-old kids that come out and you know, you see the light in their eyes and they just dedicate themselves to archaeology. You know, I'd like to see one of those people in 10 years to see whether they really stay as archaeologists. But that immediate interest is there to preserve culture and to learn more about the archaeology and learn about things that they're finding. So, and that's a very important contribution that we can make as scientists.
And we are talking about archaeology in Texas this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Question over here. Yes, sir.
I have a follow-up question for Dr. Collins. The subject was just mentioned. When you have a site like that where you have bedrock and you have a Clovis site, is it possible that you might see artifacts from previous cultures mixed in with those Clovis artifacts and some way to differentiate between the two?
The probability is that that is what you will find if there were older habitations there. And right at the moment, since we don't really know very much about what the older cultures look like, we would have a hard time sorting out that kind of admixture. So to really have a convincing case that you have a pre-Clovis artifact or assemblage of artifacts, you need to find them in good geologic context. And that's the approach that we're beginning to use much more commonly than we used to.
Are you a lone wolf now in this theory?
Oh, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of co-conspirators, and our numbers are growing. Mm-hmm. Some very prominent archaeologists in North America are proponents of the pre-Clovis concept.
But it's still being taught in textbooks as standard
Yes. It's interesting. In the last 2 weeks, I've gotten two calls from public school teachers saying, our textbook says that Clovis were the first peoples in the Americas, but my kids are telling me that's not true. Could you come talk to my class? And I love that.
1-800-989-8255. Yes, ma'am.
I have a quick question for all four of you, more about the profession. I recently finished my graduate degree in history up in New England, and I had a very hard time convincing people that there is history in Texas and that it's worthwhile to study. And my example was always, I would say, well, look at the Spanish missions. There are 16th, 17th, and 18th century Spanish missions here. And, of course, you know, revolutionary colonial history is all really focused in New England. And I guess, do you find yourselves also facing those issues because you don't think of Texas as a, you know, the hotbed for archaeology, like you would think Texas is not the hotbed for history?
Well, James Rusheth can't even get a radar to go down there and look at his ship. Britt, what do you think?
I don't think we find the same kinds of problems. There's so much archaeology here. There's such a density of sites on the landscape and under the landscape that we don't find that same problem. We're also not asking people up in the Northeast if we have archaeology. We can pretty much determine that on our own. So, you know, it's you control your own history. But, you know, let me put in a plug about Texas history. There's quite a bit of Texas history. Spanish and post-Spanish.
We're running out of time. Let me get Steve Tomka in.
Yeah, one of the things that we're trying to break through, however, is the fact that Texas history doesn't begin at the colonial period when the Spanish came in, and there's 10,000, 12,000, 14,000 years of prehistory that it also needs to be covered in the schools.
Dr. Brusheth, last comment about this?
Well, I think Texas has absolutely wonderful history. We're certainly, my agency, the Texas Historical Commission, actively promotes that. And we've heard a lot of talk about how people can get involved in archaeology. Well, this is Texas Archaeology Month. And on our website at the Texas Historical Commission, we actually have a calendar of events throughout the state of celebrations, fairs, and hands-on activities where people can get involved, learn more about our state's wonderful archaeological history.
Well, we've come full circle this hour. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. James Brusheth, Director of the Archaeology Division at the Texas Historical Commission in Austin. Michael Collins, Research Associate at the Texas Archaeological Research Laboratory, part of the University of Texas at Austin. Steve Tomka, Director of the Center for Archaeological Research, University of Texas at San Antonio. And Britt Bousman, Director of the Center for Archaeological Studies at Texas State University in San Marcos. Thank you all, gentlemen, for this stimulating hour. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Senior Producer Karen Verghoff. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. And we have special thanks today to Janet Grogene and the folks at Texas Public Radio who sponsored us, bringing us here. Also to Harcourt Assessment, Keystone School, DPT, and the Science Station, and to University of Texas Health Science Center, also for helping us host our broadcast today. If you'd like to write to us, please surf over to our website at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street. That's where you can send letters to us at the fourth floor, New York, New York, 10036. And our website is sciencefriday.com. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is up and running. We take the material we do here on Science Friday and we turn it into teaching material. And we give it away to schools and teachers can log on and download the curricula for it. Also, back editions of Science Friday, you can download them on your iPod or listen to them on Real Audio. I'm Ira Flato in San Antonio.